of the Mud Puppy Games Network.
I don't know. What do you think? Do you think a princess and a guy like me?
No.
Welcome to the Save for Half podcast, where we'll talk about old school games and the modern games inspired by them.
Long, long time ago, in a podcast far, far away, it's Save for Half, Star Wars Edition! Yes, we're finally covering the Star Wars West End Games version, D6. I am one of your hosts, DM Mike, who will be taking on the template of Alien Student of the Force for this episode. Because even when I RP, I can't get away from academia.
Now, I'm not saying it's aliens, but...
But it's aliens.
It's aliens.
We're all aliens. It's just which planet you're on.
Yep. And is next to me is DM Liz, who will be playing the Tongue-Tied Engineer template.
Hi. No, don't worry. I've got this! Sorry.
Nuclear vessels.
Wrong genre.
Or wrong franchise.
Wrong franchise.
And over there, that's DM Corbett, who will be our Mon Calamari template for the show.
That's a trap!
The good news is your field of vision is about 280 degrees.
And DM Jim will be playing the Quixotic Jedi, as in Don Quixote.
Because every day of my life just feels like that, so that's why.
And like I said, we'll be covering the Star Wars RPG put out by West End Games in 88?
7.
87, okay. But first, we normally don't do emails in the main shows, but I was petitioned to do this one.
Oh, God.
Because it's so topical, and it came in right after our Star Wars prequel episode.
I read all the emails on the face of the earth!
No emails were harmed in the making of this podcast.
And as ever, Liz will, ironically, the tongue-tied engineer, will read it.
A tongue-tied engineer with voice training.
Yeah.
I'm much better when I have a script. Okay, so we got an email from Sean Nickel, who apparently listened to our last episode where we were talking about our memories of going to see Star Wars in the theaters for the first time. And Sean writes, "Hey there, this is just a shout-out to Jim. In the last episode, Star Wars... you were all discussing the first time you watched the movie in the theater. Jim said, well, there was only one theater in Frankfort, Kentucky. Holy
free art!
I'm from Frankfort!
What are the odds?
Anyway, it was a small town moment. I was a few years younger than Jim, but I'm sure we know some of the same people, or at least families.
Hopefully not his date.
Depending on which high school Jim attended, FCHS or FHS,
Franklin County High School or Frankfort High School.
He may have known my sister, Kathy Nickel. I never thought I would hear of someone from my hometown being successful in the gaming industry, so I'm very impressed. Thumbs up. Keep up the great work on the podcast, Sean.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Sean, for listening to whatever nonsense we serve up. But you know me, I'm OCD, so I had to go look it up. Sean, I went to Franklin County High School also. I was class of 78. You were class of 84. So you were a sophomore when my little sister was a senior. So there was a chance you knew her. But I'm sorry I missed you.
Missed it by that much. All right. Well, in that case, we are going to take a pod break. When we return, we'll go right into Mike and the Mechanics.
Into a world without nearly enough quality gamer podcasts, they came. The Grognard Files, a podcast about role-playing games from back in the day. You know they're experts because they speak with British accents. Find them at armchairadventureblog.com, iTunes, or wherever fine podcasts are served.
Broadcasting from the back of a van.
What have we gotten into?
It's Radio Free Muncie. Three dudes talking about gaming and comics.
We're going to have some old school versus new school discussion.
All through the lens of the Knights of the Dinner Table comic strips.
Lair of the Gazebo classic strip.
So join us at anchor.fm/Radio Free Muncie.
Sometimes you feel like a nut, sometimes you don't. Almond Joy's got nuts, Mounds don't. Almond Joy's got real milk chocolate, coconut and munchy nuts too. Mounds got deep dark chocolate and chewy coconut. Sometimes you feel like a nut, sometimes you don't. Peter Paul, Almond Joy's got nuts, Peter Paul, Mounds don't.
Because
sometimes you feel like a nut, sometimes you don't.
This portion of the show is being brought to you by Gravity. When wanting to walk around on the side of our planet without inconveniently being flung to the far reaches of the solar system, more people choose gravity than any other force in the universe. So remember, when something has got you down, it's probably gravity. Clean, dependable, low maintenance, gravity.
It's time for Mike and the Mechanics.
Sorry. That's Mike and the Mechanics of the Game. My bad.
And the part of Mike will be played by DM Corbett, since this was his game choice.
Here's where the fun begins.
Oh, boy. Hi, I'm Mike.
Bah!
It sounds so realistic.
I'm in 3D. Okay. So Star Wars D6 system is called that because it's a system that revolves around D6s. You really don't need any other dice except for D6s, although there are a few other mechanics that throw in for tables and stuff that kind of throw it off. But hey, let's ignore that. There are six basic stats. Dexterity, knowledge, mechanical, which is your ability to use mechanical things or operate things, like also riding horses and stuff, or tauntauns or whatever. Perception, strength, and technical, which is the ability to fix and work on things. Computers, droids, ships, whatever. Everything is done with D6s, so instead of having permanent stats, you have a sort of floating stat. You have a number of dice in a pool that go into those stats. The average person has two dice, meaning two D6. So the typical, like, easy thing to do would be a 5 or better. You roll 2d6, get a 5 or better. You can kind of calculate those odds on a 2 to 12. It's, as characters, you divide up 18 d6 amongst your stats. As a human, you can never go below 2 and above 4. As an alien, you're able to do that because, obviously, Wookiees tear people's arms off and droids get their arms torn off. So there's a few extra elements that kind of throw it off, but that's the key bit. Basically, you're rolling to beat a number the DM or the game master sets it. So if it's difficult, it's 10 or 15 or 20. And you pick and adjust based on how hard you think it should be for what they're doing. Or if it's contested, then one person rolls and you roll against it. There are force points. So they can use those kind of like the Bimbo points from FemForce. Wasn't it FemForce?
Super Babes. FemForce.
Super Babes.
Yeah.
Yes. And there's also skill points, which you can use to add dice temporarily. The force points do a lot more than the Super Babes point, Bimbo points, but they're pretty similar. Very, very similar. In fact, I'm sure they got the idea from it. And the one other element is the wild die, which essentially one die should be set aside or colored different in some way. The best way to describe it is kind of like it's the critical roll. On a one, something bad happens. On a six, you roll again and keep adding until there isn't a six.
So it explodes.
Right.
Okay. Well, we're starting to get in the weeds here, so.
Okay. So basic idea, D6s. All D6s.
Okay.
All the time.
Pool-based. Everything is more or less a difficulty roll, and you try to meet or exceed that number.
Correct.
Okay. Pretty simple. Now we'll talk first impressions.
Just a first impression. I could be totally wrong. It's only a first impression. And though the impression is strong, it never can hurt to question.
Now we'll start with Jim.
Ho ho, hey ho. Greetings, program. My first impression is this is one of the all-time great RPG designs. It's just got tight, simple rule system coupled with mountains of setting and background. The D6 system is one of my favorite game engine designs, even though I've never actually gotten to play it. I only know it academically, but I've studied it. And those two things together, this is just my favorite version of Star Wars role-playing games. Sorry, Fantasy Flight Games and WotC.
Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah, don't send us your emails. Okay, do.
Okay. Corbett?
This is actually my third impression, because the first time I got it, I really didn't like it. I got it like 88, 89, fresh, and went into it, and we all approached it like it's D&D, and if you approach it like D&D, it does not work. It is messy. Mm. The second time I ran into it was at DundraCon, and it was a bunch of guys running around the convention, and we were playing it guerrilla style. Essentially, we would stop in between games, play about 15 minutes of it, and go on to some other game, and then come back out and let's play some more Star Wars for 10 minutes. And then jump into another game. And then come back out and play Star Wars for 15 minutes. And then jump into another game. My third time around, it's kind of funny going through the first book again, because it's a little clunky. I was thinking there was three editions, but there's actually only 2.5. They made a second edition, which was cleans up the first edition. And then they made a 2.5, they didn't call it that. They just called it second edition.
Revised second edition.
A lot more new art and a few more ideas, but the rules still were the same.
Okay. Liz?
Well, I was very pleasantly surprised at how much I enjoyed reading these rules. I mean, I enjoyed all the original Star Wars movies back in the day, but I never had any desire to role play in the setting. And so I never even thought about picking up this book when it came out. But reading it for the first time now, I thought, like Jim said, they're very well done. I'd love to use them to play with. Even if it wasn't using a Star Wars setting, I think they would be an excellent set of rules for any sci-fi kind of game. But yeah, I'm actually interested in playing in a Star Wars adventure now using this rule set.
Okay. My first impression. I remember when it was first out for sale at Allen's Comics and Games in Longview, Texas, and everybody was all about it. And I remember the book. I remember how thick it was. At least as compared to, say, the first edition Player's Handbook. Between my normal reluctance to play in franchise universes on top of what appeared to be a relatively thick rulebook, at least, like I said, as compared to an AD&D Player's Handbook, I just wasn't interested. I flipped through it a couple of times, but just wasn't my thing. I was happy with Traveler, didn't want to do it. But I never actually read the rules until now. And the system, as Jim and Corbett have pointed out, is simple and apparently fairly robust. I was pleasantly surprised.
Elegant, you could almost say.
Yeah, and one thing I will give it its due, unlike my fave Traveler or Star Frontiers, it has both starships and robots in the core rules. Now, granted, only 5 ships, but that's ships. It's something. And the original Black Book Traveler in the core rules didn't have more than 3 or 4 ships either. So nothing to grouse there. So
I know about you, Mike, but we were too busy playing Traveler, trying to turn it into Star Trek back then.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's because I read so much of the old Heinlein and Asimov stuff. I was more E. Doc Smith kind of space Viking kind of sci-fi that you can't really get Star Wars out of. I mean, yeah, I know Traveler did end up putting Darth Vader in Citizens of the Imperium, but realistically, Star Wars and Star Trek both, as far as tech levels, didn't entirely fit in Traveler. Star Trek, it would kind of work, I guess, if you kicked it up to tech level 15, but you'd have to kick it all the way to 15 in order to get transporters and, you know, phasers and that sort of thing. But anyway, let's go to our top fives.
For half, top five. In 5, 4, 3, 2.
And this time, we'll start with Liz.
He says as I just got finished hacking up a lung.
At least not while you were hacking up a lung.
That's true.
It is the cold and flu season.
Yeah, and allergies.
So we're both fighting.
Mountain cedar is really bad where we live right now, and I'm not good with that.
Which is ironic, because there are no mountains anywhere near us.
Yeah, well, it's called mountain cedar, but technically it's a member of the juniper family. I'm not sure how it got the mountain cedar name, but anyway.
False advertising.
Whatever it is, it's horrible, and I hate it.
So Liz's number five is Texas winters suck.
Yes. Okay. My number five. One of the things that I like about how they deal with doing multiple actions is that you can use more than one, but everyone after the first costs you a die. So the number of dice you have available limits how many uses you have. And if you're a low-level first starting out player, you're not going to be able to do just tons of things all in the same round. But the more experienced you get, the more you'll be able to do simultaneously. And I think that's a pretty elegant way of handling that, and it makes sense.
Okay. Corbett?
They didn't actually add this until the second edition, but it's still in the book. So I want to mention it. Quotes. The quotes were added into the character sheets, and it's a part where it just says quotes or a quote, and you're supposed to write in your character quote, you know, like, it's not my fault, or
I've got a bad feeling about this.
You've got a bad feeling about this, or any quote you could think of.
I'm not even supposed to be here. Oh, wait, that's Clerks.
Oh, I love that movie, too.
I think that quote is very usable in just about any situation.
Yeah, any role-playing game you can think of.
In the second edition, they added an element to put it towards your experience. Like, oh, when you use your quote in a proper way, then it adds to your character because it's something you repeat on a regular basis. And it makes it very game-like. I think it's funny they put it in the first edition. I'd forgotten they didn't have the rule in it. Just like, just put it in. Whatever. It's just for fun.
Yep.
Which is good, too.
Cool. Okay, Jim?
My number five, I'm just going to focus on the rock-solid design and physical presentation. I no longer have my original copy, but I remember it well, and I got the reprint they did a few years ago. And it's just rock-solid, old-school textbook style hardback binding and a very sophisticated, particularly for the time, layout and graphic design. Completely shunting aside that they had a mountain of photos and art supplied to them by Lucasfilm, the additional graphics and house ads look like they were designed in an ad agency. And even though it's a color art book, the regular pages are just black text on white pages with lots of air and absolutely no frivolous page backgrounds or borders. So that alone makes it an enjoyable read.
Yeah, in a way, it was kind of the anti-Traveler because Urshul Black Book Traveler had virtually no art whatsoever, whereas this thing is chock full of photos and art.
And Liz, feel free to agree or disagree, but that was my graphic design take on this book.
I liked it a lot, too. Yeah, it's no background images to muddy the text and everything. It was pretty cool. And yeah, all of the art stills that were provided, even if you weren't a fan of role-playing games at the time,
I think there was a pretty good probability that just Star Wars movie fans would, you know, be picking up the book, not necessarily because they wanted to play the game, but they just wanted all the images and photos.
Or say you're Timothy Zahn, and you've suddenly been assigned to write a trilogy about Thrawn, and Lucasfilm ships you a box of these things for background and research.
Yeah.
I will say I did love the Imperial Navy advertisement. It's one of the colors.
Yeah, that was evil. Yeah. Even back in 87 when I was decided I didn't like that, that's the one thing that stuck in my memory. I loved that two-page spread of join the Imperial Navy, be respected and admired throughout the galaxy.
The only thing they were missing was the I Want You poster with Vader pointing at you going, we need admirals every day.
Sometimes multiple times a day.
And they even sort of had the traveling to exotic worlds and meeting exciting, interesting aliens, but they left out the and kill them. Oh, well. Yeah, that was cool. But as far as my number five, I don't know for certain, but this thing really feels like it was built from the ground up as a cinematic role-playing game. And that's an easy term to bandy about now, but in 1987, that was unusual.
Hear, hear.
And I think this succeeds as a cinematic RPG. Much as I love Foz's Star Trek, I think this does actually a better job of giving that cinematic feel. By the book rules, it just encourages so much activity that may not be simulationist, but is certainly the movies. A perfect example of this rule is they're talking about opposed roles. Occasionally, you'll use a role against whether it's an arm wrestling contest or whatever. But the rules specifically say an opposed role between a player character and an NPC, the PC should always win.
If it's a tie,
always win. And that's the sort of thing that a simulationist would go, well, you need to determine strength factors and da-da-da and this and that. And I'm like, no. If it's a tie, the PC always wins.
You need to argue and debate it with a GM for 15 or 20 minutes.
Right.
Grind the whole game to a halt. That's the proper way.
Until the GM says a carton of eggs falls on your head and you die.
I think one of the things they put in the GM section is the, failing to the end of the story, essentially. Because like they said, you don't want to have a anticlimactic moment to destroy. Like you spend a whole campaign going to search out some Jedi to bring them back or some person, some artifact or whatever. And you bring it all the way back and you get to customs and then the Imperium like pounces on you. Like, well, I guess that's over. Instead, you could go, well, what if I roll to or what if the failure is, you know, I can't let you get this through customs without a fee.
Wink, wink. Yeah.
Yeah. You kind of lean into the story and things change again. And it becomes a very impromptu or not impromptu, improv.
Improv. Yeah. Yes. And.
Yeah.
But again, cinematic.
Right.
That's pretty impressive. Especially if you're going to role play Star Wars. How could you not go for a cinematic? I mean, come on. All right. Liz, four.
Okay. My number four. I guess some following up on that. The way they also lean into that is when you're making up characters, it says that every character in the group should have met and know at least one other character, and stress the fact that in the movies, all these guys at the end of the day are there for each other. They'll drop everything to come to the aid of their friends. So they really want the game table vibe to be similar. Don't have this one, I'm a loner who doesn't like anyone, and you're going to have to jump through multiple hoops to convince my character to even help you in the first place, and just grinding everything to a halt. It's like everybody should know somebody in the party somehow.
As opposed to that orphan all in black in the back corner of the tavern who will fight tooth and nail to avoid joining the party to go on the adventure.
Exactly.
Yeah. Newt from the Black Hands and Knights at Dinner Table. He couldn't play by these rules.
Okay. Corbett.
Okay. One of the reasons I picked this was because Jim had mentioned that the last Gamma World we reviewed, he was like, this rule system fits really, really well for Gamma World, and it does. It did. It does. Still does. It reminded me of this because this rule system works perfectly for the Star Wars original trilogy idea. And I will warn you this ahead of time. If you try to use it with another Star Wars, you may hurt yourself.
That's a good point. I should have mentioned that when I fit yes, the original trilogy.
Correct. Because I did use it for fantasy. And because the West End Games, after they lost the license, they made a generic D6 system. And it's fun. And it feels like Star Wars. So it's an adventure. It's high end. It's high movement. I think it was Last Unicorn that put out a Star Trek game. And Star Trek, as high end, high adventure, plays a lot like JJ Trek. If you like your Star Trek that way, that's great. But honestly, I think Star Trek itself works better as a Cthulhu style. Because it's a mystery, but again, it's the style that you want to go with, and mm-hmm. That's why I'm trying to point that out as it fits the style for the original trilogy perfectly.
You're talking about important issues because not every genre, and certainly not every genre licensed franchise, is suitable to D20. Best served by a D20 mechanic.
Yeah, and some people may love that iteration, but yeah.
All right, that's it.
Okay. Jim?
My number four, and these weeds are about to get really deep because I'm a game designer, so buckle up. I assume we all had a first edition Dungeon Master's Guide, so Gary gave us a little lesson of the difference between a linear probability curve and a bell curve probability curve, right? Mm-hmm. Linear is just a straight line, and percentile game systems would be an example of that. D&D is a mix. This D6 system, and you'll have to straighten me out, Mike. Because of my limited exposure to dice pool games like Mouse Guard, I didn't take this as a dice pool system. I look at it as a bell curve system. The bell curve just doesn't shift forward and back by a number of dice and modifiers because of the exploding wild dice mechanic in the middle of it. So it's something that I've studied called a polynomial curve. That just means a probability curve that looks like a squiggle when you graph it out. And that's why I know about the D6 system, because I've studied it, because I can't get into it too far, but the proprietary game engine I've designed for my Mega Heroes game that I will someday get done, in principle, works the same way. It's not a D6 system. It's not a D20 system. It's Jim's. I tore both the cars apart and built a new car out of them system. And I'm a big fan of that. And for the exact reason you've already talked about, that is a game engine design that leans towards the cinematic experience. And we're using that as a term, but what does that even mean? Well, it means movies that have been storyboarded and artfully directed in a way that in some ways is like a motion picture version of a comic book. You know, it's big action, slam bang. People, like Corbett said, they get stunned, wounded, incapacitated, or I forget the last one's name. Somebody check me. But you're going to die within a few rounds if they don't. Mortally wounded, yeah. But nothing like D&D, where, okay, I'm -5, now I'm -10, or 5th edition, it is like 5th edition because you're hard to kill. So 5th edition, yeah. You've got the extra death saves. You've got a while before you die in this game.
If I had to describe it, the definition simulationist is when I have a sword and I hit someone with that sword, does it as closely reflect real life as plausible in a fantasy world or whatever like that? Cinematic, whether that sword hits accurately according to physics isn't important. What's important is, does it promote the story? Does it promote the adventure? To me, that's cinematic.
And there are a few more mechanics besides the combat main action resolution system in this game that do the same thing, but we'll
right.
get to that.
Right. The force system all by itself does that.
So that's my number four. I don't want to steal anybody else's. Plus, I just like saying polynomial curve.
How often do you get to put that in conversation, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Again, talking about the simple system, the emphasis on cinematic, this is one of the few games I've ever come across where it actually encourages players with GM approval to come up with their own skills.
I was thinking of you the whole time I was reading that.
they you know, say, well, we can't cover skills for everything. And yes, that's which, as everyone who's listened to this podcast and is sick of hearing me say it, is my running argument against skill systems. You can't cover everything.
You just stole my number three, which I have written in my notes as the simple skill system that should fix everyone's problems. Cough, Mike.
You're welcome. So, yeah, it's that's a great thing. I mean, yeah, the GM still gets final approval, but the encouragement, you know, just do it. Especially like how they gave the example. On the other hand, if your player tries to come up with a skill, what was it? Imperial secret tactics and base locations. Uh-huh. It's like, yeah, you better have a real good reason why you would have that skill.
He'd write it in teeny tiny letters in the corner of the character sheet.
Yeah.
It's right here on my sheet, Chase. Look.
Exhaust port engineering.
Right below the main port.
Why, that's no different than bullsizing a Womp Rat in Beggar's Canyon.
T-16 back home, yeah.
Oh, man. You guys are reading my mind for my next one, but I think Liz is up after that.
Yep. Liz, number three.
Okay, well, I'm going to take your talk about skills and run with it. As Mike just said, he's talked about his anti-skill stance many times in the past. While I've talked about my pro-skilled stance many times in the past, and one of the things I've always said in defense of them is that many times you're playing a character who is good at something and has knowledge of something that you, as a player, don't. And I've talked about when I play my super genius scientist character, it's like, don't ask me to role play it instead of making my science skill roll. It's like, I don't know anything about science beyond high school.
Stand back. I'm going to try science.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I'll be doing a Doctor Who and talking about reversing the polarity of the neutron flow and generally not being convincing at all in a role playing situation. But that being said, the Star Wars game actually touches on this when it talks in the GM section about the fun of role-playing something as opposed to just making a role. And they specifically go into where the player does not know what their character does. And that may be a time where they're not going to role-play it well. But they say, in that regard, still try to do the role-play because that's generally more fun than just rolling dice. But in those instances, the actual role is going to be more important than the role play. So the player doesn't have to feel bad when they role play it badly. And the GM's not going to go, well, you really sucked at that, so I'm giving you a minus 10 modifier to your role. It's, you know, it's like,
sorry, what? You can only play what you actually know. So
know.
Mike has to only be the armchair historian template for
right.
all eternity.
Forever.
Or like the Matt Smith doctor, that thing he said, which I've adopted as an entire life philosophy. I just talk real fast, hope something good happens, then take the credit.
Here I am being very clever, and none of you are around to appreciate it.
Oh, that was good. That was pretty good.
Thank you. All right, Corbett, three.
Okay, touching back on the bullseyeing Womp Rats and a T-16.
Woo!
There's one mechanic in the game that makes Luke like the biggest hillbilly ever, which is the mechanic of everything scaled. So if you shoot a human to a human or a person to a person or a single target or versus a speeder or a ship versus a ship or a cruiser versus a cruiser or a Death Star. Versus
yeah, we get
Death
it.
Star. Everything has a scale. So when you go down that scale, you're infinite. Your dice go way up in damage. So if you get shot point blank with a ship weapon, like as a person, you're going to die. But the ability to get hit is pretty hard because you're so small. So it really, really, really makes Luke look like a backwoods hillbilly with a bazooka or driving down the street shooting at chickens. So I just want
to
say
be
that.
Fair. You come from Texas.
This is true.
I come from Mississippi. Yeah. So Jim's from Kentucky. So
I was just sitting here thinking how Tatooine compared analogously to Eastern Kentucky and Eastern Tennessee, Appalachia. But Texas might be a better fit.
West Texas, especially.
Well, I was going to go to Toadsuck, Arkansas to pick up some power converters. There's a mental image for you.
Weapon scale matters, and it's kind of funny.
And that's a good, simple way of handling it, as opposed to, say, doing the Palladium standard damage versus mega damage capacity, for example.
Yeah.
You know, this is a simpler way of handling it. So, yeah.
I think we can all agree it doesn't matter whether it's Eastern Kentucky or Western Texas. You don't want to just go into a trucker bar and kick in the door and start causing trouble.
Especially very wearing true. A North Texas RPG Con t-shirt. Okay, Jim. Three.
Oh, okay. My number three now is, I didn't remember this from back in the day, but I found it amazing that they actually encouraged Theater of the Mind play, because there are not many traditional RPGs. And by traditional, I just mean paper and pencil like we all play, not Vampire the Masquerade or stuff like that.
70s and 80s. Yeah.
The only RPGs I know of where they say in the rules things to encourage Theater of Mind play are OD&D, Star Wars, and Free Ad, Dungeon Crawl Classics, and Mutant Crawl Classics. I prefer Theater of the Mind play today, but I came to it very late in life because I had an original Grenadier Wizards and Warriors box set of minis that I'd gotten on eBay, like the super most collectible one, the one where the bottom of the box is lacquered. It's not just stupid cardboard. And I brought that when we got Tim to agree to run an OD&D campaign for us like 12 years ago. And I was so proud to bring that to the game. He's like, nah, we don't do that. So then we played for a year completely Theater of the Mind D&D. And I love it now. Mm-hmm. That was slightly before I discovered Dungeon Crawl Classics. Which says the same thing in the rules. You don't really need minis for this.
Well, Victorious does too, but anyway.
Oh, I missed that
paragraph. You got your game in there. I was going to kind of slip my game in under the wire.
I'm awake. The gods made me. I got that in the mail, flipped through it, and immediately call you up with, hey, in column A on page 69, it says C page XX. I saw that, but I didn't see the thing you wanted me to see. Sorry.
Yeah. Rub those typos in. not our fault. We sent the right files in. But anyway.
It happens to the best of us.
Yeah. Anyway, my third. A long, long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, they use the metric system.
Yeah.
Everyone uses metrics.
I mean, I know it's that needs something practical. And yes, they're not going to make up an entirely new measurement system just to screw with everybody. And every sci-fi game uses metrics because it's all nice and sciencey.
You can't use Imperial because that's what the Empire uses, Mike.
That would be great to run a game and like you're on a Death Star and you're running around and everything's like in turn at 300 feet. What? What's a foot?
Liz, I hadn't thought about it. It's like the English accent makes you a villain in a movie. The metric system makes you a good guy in science fiction movies. Because the Klingons are all like 400 kilograms.
Rebel base, 347.5 miles and closing.
That would be cool. Okay, Liz, too.
Ah, okay. I guess for my number two, I'm going to talk about the pretty sweet little solitaire adventure that they've got in the book.
Better than the one in Star Frontiers.
Well, I mean, it's a good length. It's
rare, much bigger than the one in Star Frontiers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good size. And apart from adding dice rolls to determine what you do, it read very much to me like the old Choose Your Own Adventure books that I used to get from Walden Books back then. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is really nicely done. I was super impressed with that. It was a pretty entertaining little story.
Okay, you're talking about the one in the front,
yes.
The Choose Your Own Adventure story?
Yeah,
okay.
Where the introduction to the concept of role-playing. You know, gotcha. Here's something for you to go through to get the idea of what it's like, you know, a little solitaire adventure. It's like, this isn't bad at all, you know.
Yeah, I was pretty impressed by that one. You can fail at it for starters, which.
Well, Liz, did you pick up on the very first example of live play in the book stars a bounty hunter and a kid?
Yes.
Like in 1987, they were thinking about the Mandalorian.
I just found that amusing because the GM was referred to as Greg, and of course, the author is Greg Costigan.
I'm sure it's totally a coincidence.
Totally.
Thank you for teaching me how to pronounce that dude's name, because I sat here and found like five different ways to say that.
Yeah, those people from up north, they're weird. All right. Any other comments, or is that it?
That's pretty much all I wanted to say about it. Okay. I don't want to spoil it for anyone.
Yeah. Corbett, two.
Okay, I'm actually going to complain about the adventure in the back. Not that it's so bad, but that was the first adventure I tried to run. The one in the back where you
And the one for the Game Masters?
Not yeah. the solo one.
Yeah, you didn't read that because that's only for Game
that's
Masters.
That's right. And it told you at the beginning of the book, you know, don't read that unless you're going to be a Game Master. And of course, everyone
every
never
player
did.
Has always done, you avoided it scrupulously.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Which in the front of the book, they tried to call Game Masters directors and then referred to them as Game Masters throughout the rest of the book.
Yeah, they gave up. Funny too. I think director would have been better, actually. It would have, again, reinforced the whole cinematicness.
My first failed experience of running the game, actually, was that adventure. And it's because it's essentially, hey, adventurers, go to this rebel base in a cave, and there's a bunch of strange things that are going to happen, and monsters and stormtroopers, and then you find a ship and you escape in the bottom. It's like, oh, so like other dungeon-y type games, maybe. It could be any game. I feel like it was a little cut and paste as far as design. However, the games, they have a whole bunch of game short ideas after that. And I really like those concepts that they improved on things a lot better. It's like, here's a paragraph. Go play. Here's some stormtroopers. Shoot at them. Go.
Yeah. Okay.
Not exactly the Clone Wars cartoon, was it?
That's true.
All right, Jim.
My number two is the genius game design behind using the Force as an impromptu alignment system, which works surprisingly well. Everybody gets Force points, so you don't have to be a Jedi. All right, right out the gate, we've ducked one of the fundamental flaws in every Star Wars game. I don't know if any of you guys played Star Wars Galaxy, but I was out as soon as that M-Org turned into everybody has to be a Jedi. When you use the Force point, it's tracked, whether you start piling up dark side points, before you even think about running a Jedi character, if you use your Force point to achieve and it's kind of a forerunner of the luck point mechanic, except it's also kind of a storytelling point game mechanic at the same time. It sort of dual roles as both of those, but spend that Force point on just staying alive. So that's selfish, but that's not evil. So you just spend the point and you don't get it back. You do something heroic to save a bunch of lives, you spend it and you get it right back. And then instead of an experience point system, depending on how the adventure went, you might get another Force point to spend in the next game. And the rules on where you can only do it so many times a game, so it just doesn't turn into Star Wars fan fiction. Mm. I thought that was just all very sweet, elegant game design.
Or somebody, a player that forgets about their Force points, Alex, who would then like store up 8 or 9 and then just blow them all in one shotgun, you know?
Yeah. That's not good.
Got all these.
What did it say? You only get a maximum of 3 and it's still GM discretion?
Yeah. And bless them for saying that if you get too many dark side points and for every dark side point you get a roll. And if you roll below that number, you go to the dark side and you stop being a player character.
Yeah.
That was some old school game rules writing there. And the GM will take your character sheet. He's an NPC now.
Yeah. And then he may show up again as a villain later on.
Yep.
Like, thank you. Because Liz, you can attest here the number of people we played with who would be like, yeah, I want to be dark side, dark force. Yeah, dark side of the force. Yeah.
I hear they have cookies, but I'm not impressed with that.
Notice they don't say good cookies.
That is true.
Just cookies. And they could be fibbing, but they are the dark side. So, you know.
This oatmeal cookie's burnt to hell. Where'd you cook it? Mustafar?
Yeah. Alderaan. Too soon. Too soon.
I think you just got a dark side point.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, you could be right. All right, my number two.
Oh, here comes a ba.
Imperial stormtroopers have 4 dice in weapon accuracy. I don't think so.
Well, we are trying to maintain the Star Wars atmosphere here. So.
Yeah. No, I don't think so.
Only if they rig their dice illegally to only roll once.
Yeah, as a GM, you get those quote-unquote average dice and roll them for when the stormtroopers shoot.
Only Imperial stormtroopers are so precise.
I still maintain that's Jedi humor. These blast points, too accurate for sand people. Yeah, sure.
Well, now that we've seen like the Ian McGregor version, we know he was just snarking.
Yeah, that has to be snarking. Okay, number one, Liz, bring us home.
All right, my number one. Da, 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 da. Well, I'm going to go with the mechanic for being mortally wounded is very streamlined, very nice. At the end of every combat round, you roll two dice, and if the number rolled is less than the number of rounds since you were mortally wounded, you are dead. So when the wound first happens, it's very unlikely that you are going to die, but the longer it goes on before you're treated, the greater the chance that you're going to succumb to your wounds and you'll be out of there.
It's a death store mechanic that doesn't run into the problem in AD&D that, what are you at? Well, I'm at -2. Okay, so we've got 8 rounds to get to you and get you bandaged before
right.
you die.
Right, you
so
don't really know.
You don't know.
I mean, it's unlikely at the beginning, but it's not impossible.
Yeah.
I still think like a magic user in D&D no matter what, because I'm sitting here thinking, okay, if the four of us were playing this game as a group, my first life goal is to get my hands on a Bacta tank and some repulsor discs, and I'll wear one of the repulsor discs around my neck like a necklace. So I go down, you just activate that thing, cancel out my gravity, and throw me at the Bacta tank. That's player character thinking right there.
Yo, yeah. Okay. Corbett.
I'm kind of going to go back. I'm going to backpedal a little to one of Jim's earlier thoughts about how it's a cinematic game and story play and everything. I just want to reemphasize this is actually the game that really taught me to play the game in scenes. Like, okay, we're in the cantina. Okay, now we're in the hangar. Okay, now we're on the run. Okay, now we're on the secret base. Okay, now we're trying to run through the secret base. Okay, now we're in the garbage compactor. Okay, now we're getting out of there. You know,
need to role play the 1 hour that you're on the escalator at the starport.
Oh my gosh. We all want to go to the arcade. We don't want to.
I want to spend 3 hours shopping.
But when I was playing it at DunderCon, that really kind of, because we had those 10 minutes of like, okay, quick, let's play. Bam, 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 bam. Go to the next game. Okay, and we break from the next game and come back like, let's play some more. Bam, 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 bam. And just go to the next one. And it was very fast and very intense. And I kind of realized, oh, it's still part of the same story. We're just in a different part now. And you kind of move on and move on. And it is very action-based as long as you don't sit there and dwell on, yeah, well, how do we get from the cantina to the hangar?
But let me ask you this, Corbett.
No, boy.
In Star Wars, how much is a ladder?
It's not in the main book. It's not in the main book, but it is in, I believe it's the recon guide, where they talk about scouts and stuff.
Ah, because scouts have ladders. Scouts and ladders are friends.
I think that's hysterical that you actually know that, Corbett.
I have almost all the books because I was crazy. But it's fun. It's a fun game. It's a fun game. And it is a great reference point. Anyway.
Do you remember the Han Solo at Star's End novels by Brian Daley?
Oh, yeah. Those were really fun.
Did they ever do supplements for, like, the corporate sector?
Yeah. That was, I think, I want to say Galaxy Guide 6 or 7.
Oh, cool. Well, as long as they did it, that's cool. Because I grew up reading those, and that was cool. Okay, Jim?
My number one is sorry in advance for about something I go on and on about at the drop of a hat, so somebody drop their hat. This Star Wars role-playing game is an excellent example of how the right genre license can work as a role-playing game. Star Wars, very similar to the same designer's immediate ancestor game, Ghostbusters, as a setting, both feature a gang of characters with differing skill sets uniting to go explore and screw over the bad guys. Okay, that's enough of a similar dynamic to D&D, the initial premise for all role-playing games, that it works. As opposed to, okay, we're playing the Star Trek role-playing game, who gets to be the captain? We're playing Doctor who gets to be a Time Lord? Superheroes are a difficult fit for role-playing games because you have to be a team to play together, right? Mm-hmm. And not every comic book character. So on and on. This is just a good example. And I understand that there's a tension between making money, the business side, and the designer side. But Star Wars was like the best of both worlds. It's a fantastic license. I'm sure they had to pay through the nose to get it, although maybe not so much in 87, because as we know, the franchise was dead at that point, and this game helped bring it back.
They'll never make another one.
Okay. This is going to be, I'm going to give one and then an honorable mention. But my number one, and this disappointed me. Maybe I just missed it, in which case somebody can correct me, but I did not find anywhere rules for dismembering. Well, Luke had his hand cut off.
It's a mortal wound. So it's kind of the, I've had that happen in a game where somebody took a mortal wound and I didn't want them to die. So I had them essentially be, they lost a leg or something. And they kind of continued the game in pain and struggling.
So they get a cool cybernetic leg with a laser in it or something?
No.
A cybernetic leg with a laser in it? What are you talking about? It should be jump jets. Jet boots with a cybernetic leg.
Well, you see, you can have the laser in the knee, so when you bend your knee, you can shoot, but the jump jet is in the foot, so, you know.
Yeah, but if you only have one jump jet, you're going to be going off at a weird angle every time you try to do anything.
Point yourself in the right direction, so you angle toward your opponent.
Well, I partly take it back, because Boba Fett was able to aim those little knee missiles somehow.
Yeah.
But he couldn't aim his jump jet very well, but anyway.
But that is correct. There is no official dismemberment. You are correct. You can't cut off somebody's arm and say a cantina, or rip their arm off when you don't win at chess.
Yeah. Right.
Or pull somebody's hand off because you don't like your dad anymore.
Yeah.
As you do.
As you do. And my honorable mention, this is funny, but when I was reading about the difficulty numbers for various skill checks, I was on my back porch reading the book while listening to some music, and I burst out laughing, probably loud enough for my neighbors to hear, because it said, you know, but how does one determine the difficulty number? It's very simple.
That's usually a prelude to a 5-page long thing.
As we know, when it says it's very simple, they lie. But this time, it really was simple. 5, 10, 15, 20, that's it.
Yeah.
But I just found it funny that, you know, I hit, it's very simple, and I flinched, you know, just a gut inherent reaction. 5 years of this show has done that to me.
I'm about to read a dissertation on how this rule works.
And with 2 pages of flowcharts. All right. Well, let's have another pod break. And then when we come back, we'll talk about saves.
Here at This Old Dungeon, we know times are tough.
My wife was pregnant with our 5th alpha when they told me they didn't need no Cooper no more at the Shady Dragon Trading Post. I had the basic rule books and only a worn-out copy of B2. I thought the adventures were over for me and my group. Then I discovered This Old Dungeon. Thanks to This Old Dungeon, my group and I are back at Gatey, and those caves are more chaotic than ever.
With all the money I've spent on minis, I don't have the cash for those newfangled 200-page full-color adventures. But thanks to This Old Dungeon, I've been running my group through the same copy of Against the Giants since 2018. It was easy after listening to them. I just replaced the giants with ogres, then minotaurs, then wereboars, then magically enlarged kobolds.
This Old Dungeon is the program where old adventures are made new again. Come listen to hosts Bill, Edwin, and Lou as they reminisce about classic game publications and discuss how to renovate them for an all-new tabletop experience. Catch This Old Dungeon from your podcatcher of choice.
Hey everyone, this is Tim from Tomorrow's End Podcast. If you're interested in post-apocalyptic Morrow Project, then Tomorrow's End Podcast is for you. You can hear us at tomorrowsend.org, or you can find us on iTunes, Google Play, Facebook, and more.
Now, it's here. The excitement, the adventure of a new force at breakfast.
We'll call them C-3POs.
New C-3PO cereal from Kellogg's. Twin wings, phased together. For two crunches in every 00. A delicious part of this nutritious breakfast. Now you can experience the taste of Kellogg's C-3POs. A crunchy new force at breakfast.
May the force be with you.
What did you like better, Jedi or The Empire Strikes Back?
Empire.
Blasphemy.
Empire had the better ending. I mean, Luke gets his hand cut off, finds out Vader's his father, hand gets frozen and taken away by Boba Fett. It ends on such a down note. I mean, that's what life is, a series of down endings. All Jedi had was a bunch of Muppets.
What makes a save, and what is going to take?
Free art!
All right, saves. And just for that, Jim, what makes a save?
What makes a save is, like I said earlier, don't write us, but I think this is the best version of a Star Wars RPG that was ever created. I'm in awe of and worship the game engine of this thing, and it's Star Wars. And I'm one of those guys where, you know, if it has to be Star Trek versus Star Wars, I'm on Team Trek. But I love Star Wars. I'm sorry, I'm about to get off on a tangent about how today you have to rage against everything. Bad Star Wars, even bad Star Wars, it's like bad sex or bad pizza. It's still pretty good. I watch it all. But this is the best. So if that's what you want, play this.
Okay. And?
Oh, what doesn't make the save? I'm sorry. I got nothing. This is a near-perfect RPG design.
Okay.
Wow.
High praise indeed. Corbett?
What really makes the save for the game is the wild dice, because it gives the mechanic of things breaking and things succeeding tremendously. You know, you can blow up an entire Death Star with one hit. You can swing across a chasm while carrying a princess. You can get out of a trash compactor right before it crushes you because of that exploding die giving you infinite amounts of points. Or something terrible happening, like walking into a detention block and saying, oh, we're here for prisoner transfer, roll the convince roll. Oh, you failed that and you got a one, or you succeeded and got a one. So like he kind of believes you, but he wants to check it out. So you shoot everybody in the room
out,
and get great
loose
rolls. And then they call back because they hear all the explosions. Like, hey, what happened up there? Let me roll the convince roll. One again. Bad reactor leak.
And Liz says, you call this a rescue?
So you can kind of see how the mechanics of the way the movie field around it and fits it. It fits around the wild dice pretty well.
You know, it's a variant on Liz's argument about critical hits and misses. They frequently make for the best stories.
Absolutely. And it works perfectly. It's all about improv, so it works really well.
Yeah.
But what fails the save is the wild dice. Because.
I see what you did there.
No.
I've created
this
a
is
monster.
Important. No. This is because I've played it as long as I did. I had campaigns that ran years. Mm-hmm. And people would become the Yodas and the Vaders and all those guys. Ooh. And when you have a wild dice and like 9 dice in your pool, it's like, yeah, you succeed by a mile, but you rolled a 1, so you drop your lightsaber or whatever. You know, it becomes like ridiculous at the high level.
Which is the real reason why Vader wore the armor.
I'm still not hearing a problem.
Well, it just is a downside as far as you can't get away with playing the master level without it being ridiculous because it doesn't fit. The game mechanics work great for that low level. We're running and we're having fun. When you get to the point that you are perfectly good, it's funky.
You just need you could fix all of that with a house rule where the director goes back and edits the past adventure and sticks in a bunch of CGI that changes stuff.
Hey, you did shoot first.
Right. One house rule and you fixed it.
That's not how I remember it. Yes, but this is how it happened.
See, Anakin was younger now.
And he built C-3PO. What? Okay. All right, Liz?
Okay, makes the save. The rules, very well done, very intuitive, as we've all said at one point or another during this episode, they really help to capture the feel of the movies. And I would say it's not just cinematic, it's feel-good cinematic.
Oh, there you go.
And
good point.
Yeah.
Good is good, evil is evil. There's not a lot of gray areas in the way this game is supposed to be run. Everything is very cut and dried. And we've covered other games in the past, like James Spawn's The Hero's Journey, that have that feel-good, camaraderie-based setting. Mm-hmm. And I have always especially loved that when it comes baked into a game.
That was a really apt comparison.
It's the kind of group of players I want to be with. And games like this, which encourage that kind of play, are always, always A+ with me. So that's my makes the save for this game. What doesn't make the save? This one's really hard because, I mean, there was a lot I enjoyed about this rule set. The closest I could get was
I personally would want to ignore the optional rules for combat that are given, where you get into the weeds with movement points, facing, stance, you know.
I was there for the war gamers.
Yeah. I mean, if you like your combat crunchy, you know, this won't be a problem for you. Like Mike said, you know, if you're a war gamer at heart, you'll be all over that. I just want to get on with things. So I didn't care for those, but I was glad that they were optional and they're not hard baked into the game where you have to use them. So it kind of doesn't, but it's optional. So that does. I don't know. Anyway.
Close enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. My save. This is a really good game system. It's simple. It would be easy to run something off the cuff with this. If I didn't play or run Star Wars with it, I'd be willing to use it to, like, run Blake 7 or something else like that with it.
Ooh.
I think it would work really well. It's just got a great feel to it, and what minor problems it has are easily fixable. Again, much like everyone else, not making the save was tough. The thing, and this is just about me, no one else, but if I had anything that's a negative, it's my general reluctance to play in franchise universes. And that's just me.
It makes total sense, though, because look at the time we grew up when it was more do-it-yourself because there wasn't that much stuff out there, and then we became game designers.
Yeah. Now, if somebody was going to run this just as the first trilogy, I'd be more willing to consider it. Heck, just the first movie. Maybe the movie and Splinter in the Mind's Eye, for those who remember that novel.
Oh, deep cut.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Han Solo, it stars, you know, the Han Solo novels from Daily. I'd love to play that.
The Marvel Star Wars comics after the adaptation.
Yeah, once they had to pretty much make up their own stuff, like that.
Giant green space bunny with pistols? Go!
Or that red-haired pirate who managed to capture his own Star Destroyer and was running around as a Star Destroyer pirate captain. Mm-hmm. That was pretty sweet. And that's all I can come up with. It's a great game. And thanks, Corbett, for choosing it. It was pretty awesome.
I want to mark this occasion because I think this is the most in agreement the four of our opinions have ever been for a game Corbett picked.
I will admit, I had a lot of worries going into it. Like, oh man, you guys are going to rip at a new one. All the things I've never thought about are going to be brought out and displayed in front of me.
Well, there wasn't that much wrong. I mean, now, if I could just choose a game that everyone would feel that way about, if only.
You have.
One day. I have?
Surely. I mean, I can't think of one, but surely.
I don't think I have.
Well, I think you did choose a game where all of us agreed that it was terrible.
That's true.
But we were all in agreement.
I'm thinking all like it. All like
Okay. So agreement is not enough.
Right.
And once in a while, that's okay, as long as we don't go full 2024 with just raging on something that's terrible. The more the I like it when we do the more than Mystery Science 3000. Okay. Yeah. Time ship. It should have time ships in it, maybe.
As long as there's no Jim, you ignorant slut kind of thing going on.
Oh, even that's okay.
All right, well, this has been West End Games' Star Wars by Greg Costigan and chosen by Corbett. Thank you, Corbett, again. We will see everybody anon. Say goodnight, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
See ya.
Live long and wait, no, not that one.
Wrong one.
May the something be with you. I don't know.
No, we rehearse this, Corbett. Come on.
It's a pre-arc! And we're out.
The Save for Half podcast is a production of the Mudpuppy Games Network and the Gagman Podcast. The Save for Half theme music is provided by the band Mississippi Bones. You can find them at mississippibones.bandcamp.com. All player characters mentioned in this podcast are fictional, and any resemblance to PCs living or dead is purely coincidental. No NPCs were harmed in the making of this podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Save for Half.
More than 20 is like a 60.